We are sitting in the WJXC studio. It's right around 5:30. I'm sitting with Meryl Agish. Meryl just got into town. She is the technical assistant for Oral History Summer School. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a long day, and we just wrapped the class up about 10 minutes ago, and we ran over here in the car. So I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I'm really excited. So it's been a long day, and you guys have had a solid day of studying oral history.
Nonstop, from 10 a.m. till almost 5:30. It's been all oral history all the time.
But you have a pretty extensive background in oral history already.
Yeah, I do. I met Suzanne Snyder, the founder of the Oral History Summer School here in Hudson, about 6 or 7 years ago in New York. After a really great recommendation from a woman I met who was taking Suzanne's oral history class at the new school, I kept it in my mind. And then a year later, about 6 or 7 years ago, I took Suzanne's class. And like I was telling the class this morning, too, it was a transformative experience. And I'd like to think of Suzanne as my oral history guru.
Fantastic. You had been doing oral history prior to that class, or you'd had a little bit of background?
I think informally.
Informally.
My family is all obsessed with talking about the past and talking about different collective memories and individual memories. My entire life, I've been hearing about this. And so when I heard about oral history first, it just felt like a natural connection. And as I got to learn more about it, and I still learn a lot about it all the time, it was a natural fit for what I've been doing my whole life, which is listening to people telling stories about things and places that I really don't know very much about.
You're going to be creating a documentary traveling to China and Japan.
Yes.
To sort of investigate your past.
Yes.
Tartars.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it's sort of a funny, you know, factoid that I reveal about myself at parties or anything like that. My family on both sides, as far as we know, are 100% Tatar. Tatar people it's the largest ethnic minority group in Russia. Since Russia is just so big, it's so vast, the empire took up so much space in Asia and Europe in the last centuries that it encompasses a lot of different ethnic groups beyond Russians. And my family comes historically, I guess, from an area in central Russia, right on the European-Asian border, mm-hmm. that was settled by nomadic people who are associated with the Golden Horde and Genghis Khan and the Mongolians centuries and centuries ago. And Tatarstan in Russia is its own entity. They're still within Russia. But anyway, at the turn of the last century, a lot of people started to leave. A lot of Tatars, a lot of Russians, just in general, started to leave the Russian Empire to pursue economic opportunities outside of Russia. So my family ended up in China, in this little fishing village that had really grown up around the extension of the Trans-Siberian Railway. And it became a real cosmopolitan center. My mother's family and my father's family were both in Harbin, in Manchuria, along with many different expats from all around Europe and Asia. And it was this fascinating little town of 100,000 people, I think, at the time that they were living there, all in different ethnic neighborhoods with a lot of exchange going on. And they lived there during the two world wars and got to experience communism adjacent to the Russian Empire. And that's why they ended up in China. They couldn't go back home when the communists came to power. And when the communists came to power in China, it was a secondary exile, since they were forced to face two options. One was forcible repatriation to communist Russia at that point, which they did not want to do, or forced exile. So they opted for exile. And at that point, the community splintered. So it was this Tatar community that really had a real presence in Harbin. And they moved on to Japan, to Australia, to Germany, back to Russia in some instances, and to Turkey. My parents were both born in China. They left as babies or toddlers and grew up in Turkey, and then eventually came to the United States, to Queens, where I was born and where my parents still live. And a lot of the community who left Turkey, who left China, who left Tatarstan, a lot of them are in the tri-state area.
And so how long were they in Turkey?
They were in Turkey. A lot of them still remain mm-hmm. in Turkey. My side of the family, my mom's side was there for about a decade. My dad's side for about 2 decades before they moved to the States.
Together?
No, separately. They had this funny mirrored movement where I think they knew each other in the family lore as their very distant cousins. Because when my mom got married, her last name was Agi, A-G-I, and all she had to add it when she got married was the S-H to Agish, A-G-I-S-H. So they think it's some kind of family connection. But they met in New York through the American Tatar Association that was founded about 80 years ago with different waves of Tatar immigrants who were coming to New York City. And they met through, you know, community activities and through mutual friends, mutual relatives in some cases. And like many of their friends of that generation, they fell in love and got married.
And so with such a sort of exile-prone background, how important is it for your folks in New York to stay within a community of Tatars or to visit the various places that they have lived?
It's so important to them, and it's so important to the older generation. You know, my aunts and uncles who are in their 70s and 80s, there's incredible maintenance of connections between all these really far-flung places. They still have very close friends who live in Australia who they haven't seen in decades. In Turkey, in Finland, there's just so many connections that cross all kinds of borders, and the common connection is the Tatar culture. And now, since the fall of communism, there have been newer waves of Tatars coming in, so my family is kind of the older guard who came in before the fall of communism. And now there are more recent emigrants who have come to New York, to Virginia, to the United States, and we come across them all the time. And it's really incredible to think that the Tatars are a sizable ethnic minority in Russia, but they're not huge. But we're everywhere, and we run into each other all the time. When I was a kid, I used to go to Finland for summer camp. It was Tatar summer camp because there is a very big Tatar community in Helsinki and in Estonia and Sweden. And it was this crazy thing because it's not like my family is some kind of fancy, wealthy background. But we were able to go to Finland to be with our fellow Tatar kids for a couple of weeks and learn the language. Well, we grew up speaking the language, but to learn poems, to learn plays, to learn songs, to learn about the Muslim faith since the Tatars are Muslims, and just spend a couple of weeks together with these kids who are from all over Europe and all over the U.S.
Can you tell me a little bit about the language?
The language is very closely related to Turkish, because I think historically with the movement of the Golden Horde, any linguist should feel free to correct me, but I think that's why there are very strong connections between Turkish, Hungarian, Finnish, Korean also. They're all in the same family group. The way that we speak it now, you know, decades removed from our country of origin, it's a little bit of Tatar English mix with some Russian and Turkish thrown in, sometimes Chinese too, and it really reflects where the family has gone through and the words that we pick up for things that have come up in our lives that we don't have a Tatar word for. And at this point, I feel much more fluent in English, but I can speak Tatar. I speak Tatar with my parents, with my aunts and uncles, with the older generation especially. And it is very helpful in public settings when you want to do a little bit of gossip about somebody. Let's say you're on the subway train or you're waiting in line, and my sister or my brother and I will just launch into Tatar to kind of whisper about something, because there's never the fear that somebody would understand, except that once happened. My mom and I were on a bus going from New York to D.C. to visit her sister, and this man next to us, his ears kept perking up. We could see he was picking up on some things that we were talking about, and it turns out that he's Uzbek. He's from the Uzbek community in New Jersey, and the Uzbek language and Tatar are also very close. So he could understand a bunch of things mm-hmm. and kind of filled in the gaps, and then we ended up having a long conversation. Basically, my mom and this man became the best of friends over the course of a 5-hour bus ride, because there was such a strange, common cultural connection there.
Right. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So can you tell me, so you sort of had the option of going to the small fishing town in China or maybe Turkey. So mm-hmm. is there, what is it about wanting to return to China specifically to make a documentary?
Well, I really am interested in China because it's the most recent place where there's the oldest living memory of what the Tatar community was like. I use the example of my uncle, my mom's oldest brother, who's about to turn 80. He's a retired car mechanic. He moved with his family to Queens, this very thoughtful, cerebral man. And he's always been obsessed with maps. My whole life, whenever I go over to his house, he always has maps, like these beautiful atlases, all kinds of things. And now with the magic of Google Earth, he goes and visits Harbin, you know, the city, his hometown, essentially, where he grew up. He left when he was 18 years old, so he really remembers it very clearly, and it was such a formative place. Whereas my mother left when she was not even a one-year-old, so she has no connection, and she really has no interest in ever going back, but there's something there that keeps pulling my uncle back. And I want to go back while this oldest generation is still alive so that I can be kind of a mediator between the past and what it is now, since at this point I don't think any of them will go back. It's been too long. They're rather old, and a lot of them they don't like to travel as much, especially such long distances. And I think it's just so different. When they left, it was a city of 100,000. Now it's a city of about 10 million. So it's changed utterly and completely. So I want to go back and see where was that neighborhood, kind of walk the outline and report back and see how it's changed, and also see what remains. There's a Tatar mosque that's still there and it's still standing, and I'm really curious, who uses it now? What purpose does it serve in the community? And with the fall of communism again in Russia, there have been a new influx of Russian expats who go between Russia and China, and I'm sure inevitably there must be some Tatars. So how does that older Tatar culture connect to modern Tatar culture? And you know, just get a sense of how all these different flows between places and time, how they interact in that specific part of China.
Mm-hmm. Have you met anyone your age who's gone back, or have you found places to research to kind of have a mental image of what the discrepancy between the past and present is? Or is it more like you're going to, does it feel a little bit like the unknown, like you're going to do a lot of exploring?
I think it's so unknown, and I haven't done enough archival research yet, but my family and our community, they still have a lot of old photographs. So using those kind of as guides to see, you know, are there any landscape shots? Are there any building shots? There are also many different ethnic groups who are living there at the time. There's a Jewish center in Harbin now that has really flourished recently. Mm-hmm. And so there are other sources, too, that I can look to. But for my own project, I want it to be unknown, and I want to see what's there. I don't want to prepare too much or overly prepare before going. We have a couple of family friends who have gone back, some who left when they were babies and they don't remember, so it's new to them. But a few years ago, two of my aunts and my great aunt went, and my great aunt remembers it really vividly. And it's fascinating to hear about a place that's so familiar and so central to who you are just be completely unrecognizable, and there's no indication that my great aunt was ever there because it's changed so much. But there have to be indications, and that's what I'm interested in finding with the project.
Out of curiosity, in terms of how you're forming the project, you have such a strong, tight-knit community existing in New York City. Do you feel like you want to couple it with oral history, people recounting the place?
Yes.
And then how it actually is and trying to sort of bring back what is?
Mm-hmm. And recreating, before I go to China, recreating through oral history interviews what that place was like and how it still exists in people's memories, because people talk about it all the time. It comes up in almost every family gathering. Mm. And that's going to end at some point. when that's no longer a living memory, when that memory passes, and it just feels so personally urgent to do it now before those memories fade or before they completely vanish. And it's more of a firsthand thing. You know, the people who grew up in Harbin and who remember what it was like living there and have now this great span of time after living in Tatar communities in Turkey, in Tatar communities in New York, how it's changed over these different iterations too, and then comparing it, I hope, if I ever get more funding, to go to Australia, to go to Finland, to go to these different areas too, and build up what this Tatar diaspora dispersal means still, because the language continues and the culture continues against really all odds, and it's a remarkable group to be a part of, even as we've integrated very well and we've really adopted American culture, you know, within my community, but there's still such strong identifications with a country that we have not lived in for 100 years.
Do you find that you, kind of coming from New York City, where there is a large immigration population, is this something that do you find pulls on your heartstrings the most in terms of conversation and oral history? And
yeah.
Yeah. Like, you have so many more projects to draw upon.
I have so many projects, and so many of them stem from my personal experience in an immigrant culture, in a capsule culture, in a culture that lives right alongside so many others that exist in very similar circumstances. Queens always seems like this entry point to America, to the United States, and so many people remain there, even after, you know, a generation or two. My parents were very strongly against moving to the suburbs. They wanted to stay in the city, and I'm very thankful for that. And it's true all across the country, I think. There are just so many different immigrant clusters and immigrant cultures that coexist, but in Queens, it's really incredible how these different groups put a very, what it feels like, permanent mark on the landscape of the city and the culture of the city. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can't avoid it if you live in a place like New York.
Are you planning on going to Harbin with anyone?
Yes, with my husband, who's a photographer and a graphic designer. And so between my oral history and audio expertise and his photographic skills, to do a multimedia project and see what happens.
Okay. And what's his background?
He's a kind of a European mix. He's Polish, French, English, Scottish, all kinds of things, named after Pope John Paul. So very different background, but we actually have a lot in common when it comes to families and thinking about roots and origins.
Mm-hmm. And is this one of your main projects, or are you also coupling it with some others? I know you are actually going to be going to graduate school.
Yes. I'm going to CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism in the fall, and I'm very excited to see how oral history and journalism can work together and work in opposition, since they're really very different ways of operating around many common interests. My goal is really to beef up my recording skills, my photography skills, my filmmaking skills, just everything, so that I can be a really good documentarian beyond journalism, with journalism and with oral history, I should say. So my Tatar project is, I think, the first one that I need to do. I've done projects on smaller scales, but this is really getting ambitious in a way that I haven't been able to do in the past, because I just wasn't ready yet. And I think it just feels so urgent, and it's such a huge undertaking for me personally. And just the fact that it has to take me out of my comfort zone and go to a completely unknown place that I've never been to before. We'll see what happens, but that's going to be the first giant international project. And then we'll see, when my brain space clears up a little bit, what comes next.
Is there, just to sort of round out the interview, is there something very specifically that you're most excited about, or inversely, something you're petrified about finding out?
Oh, man. I think one of the things that petrifies me is that I'll find that there are just a lot of dead ends, and that there's a lot of mystery in my mind now. What is Harbin like? What does it mean to everybody? And it, I know it's really important, but maybe I'm imagining that. And some of these things I won't find out until I get there, and I don't want it to feel like a failed project if there's just nothing for me to grasp onto. So that's why I'm very open to seeing what happens when I get there.
Mm-hmm. Meryl, thank you so much for joining me on the WGXC.
Thank you, Melinda. Monday afternoon show. This was really fun.
For people who are interested in learning a little bit more about the project or you, is there, do you have a website? Or
I do, and my website is in formation right now, and my name is a little complicated, so I think the easiest thing is to look for Oral History Summer School. Just search for that. You'll come up with our site for the workshop, and I'm listed there, mm-hmm. and then you can click on that and find me.
Fantastic. And you're going to be here throughout the next 2 weeks?
Yes, I'll be here until the 17th, the 18th. So I'll be here for the duration.
So you're going to be doing all the workshops?
Oh, yes. Every single one.
So I'm glad we're doing the interview before and not on the 17th.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I would have just been fried at that point. I don't know. But it's an exciting time, and I'm really happy to be here.